Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Xero Accounting Software presents Small Business Challenge.
Hello and welcome to our 30-second podcast. I'm your host, Ollie, and today my guest is Terry the Tough Guy. He's notorious for getting bills paid quickly.
Sure am, Ollie. Let's crack some knuckles, shall we?
So what's your advice for an unpaid invoice?
Use Xero. It's accounting software that can notify customers if they haven't paid you.
Sounds beautiful.
Oh, it is.
Really?
Golden.
Connect your business at xero.com.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Jonathan Savage, and in the early hours of Wednesday, the 19th of February, these are our main stories. A billionaire with his eyes on the White House, Michael Bloomberg, gets his way and will face Democratic rivals in a TV debate. Movie mogul Harvey Weinstein awaits the jury's verdict, and one of the most powerful men in Putin's Russia leaves office. Also in this podcast.
It's a big plan to get the bushfire-affected areas back on their feet. I mean, it's a very practical thing, putting fences back up so stock do not just roam everywhere.
Australia offers backpackers an incentive as the country battles back. In a way, Michael Bloomberg's been part of the US presidential tussle for months. His TV adverts have been unmissable even in the DVR age. But despite not being on the ballot in the Iowa caucus or New Hampshire primary, Mr. Bloomberg will now be part of TV debates with the other candidates who want to be the Democratic Party's nominee. He's a 78-year-old billionaire who used to be mayor of New York and founded the Bloomberg Financial Data Software and Media Company. To find out why he's only just earned a podium of his own, I spoke to our Washington reporter, Anthony Zerker.
Because he didn't qualify for the debates up until now. There was a requirement that you have a certain number of small donations from the public, and Michael Bloomberg, his only donor is himself. So he didn't hit that mark. The Democratic Party changed those qualification requirements for this debate, made it purely based on poll numbers or if you had already won one of the previous contest delegates there. So all of a sudden, he qualifies. And there are some other candidates who think that this is unfair, that the criteria essentially has been crafted so that he could get a spot on the debate stage.
It is a crowded field still, really. What are his political positions? How will he stand out?
Well, he falls into the moderate category of Democratic candidates mostly. I mean, he was a Republican mayor of New York for quite some time before switching to being an independent and then a Democrat. Although if you look at some of his other policies on gun control, on addressing climate change, on tackling cigarette smoking, he actually is either in the mainstream or a little bit to the left of the average Democrat. So it's kind of a hodgepodge. The thing that I think you're going to see him attacked on most is his support of a policy called Stop and Frisk, which allowed New York City police officers to essentially search any kind of suspicious-looking black men or anyone, for that matter, that they decided might be concealing some sort of contraband or a weapon. That was viewed by many as being targeted towards the African-American community and a violation of their civil rights.
You mentioned that some Democrats don't feel that he should be part of this debate. Are they actually worried about Michael Bloomberg?
When someone is spending, I think we're at $400 million now in advertising for their presidential campaign, it's unquestionable that they're going to be worried about that. They see Michael Bloomberg rising in the polls. They view that as a threat. And I think you're going to see candidates on the left come at him as trying to buy his way to a presidential nomination, and candidates who are more moderate in the center who feel that he's threatening their ability to appeal to those more towards the middle, the Democratic voters, and they'll go after him as being either Republican in Democrats' clothing or criticize allegations of sexual harassment that have been made to him and creating a hostile workplace towards women in his media empire. All of that, I think, is going to come up. So he's going to be the center of a whirlwind on that debate stage starting Wednesday night.
Anthony Zerker. The judge in the Harvey Weinstein trial has warned the film's producer's lawyer not to talk to the press until the jury has reached a verdict. Last weekend, Mr. Weinstein's attorney used an opinion piece in a newspaper to urge jurors to look past the headlines the case had generated. Mr. Weinstein denies charges of rape and sexual assault. From New York, our correspondent Nick Bryant.
As the jury started its deliberations, the judge delivered a stern warning to the lead defence lawyer in the trial not to speak to the press until after the verdict is delivered. I would caution you about the tentacles of your public relations juggernaut, Justice James Burke told Donna Rotunno, a key and highly public figure in this trial. The defence team has been trying to sow seeds of doubt by citing warm emails and other communications between Harvey Weinstein and his female accusers that continued for months after the alleged attacks. The movie mogul has expressed delight at Donna Rotunno's performance in court. "I made the King's speech," he joked to reporters after her closing argument last week. "It was the Queen's speech." Some legal analysts believe the trial will end with his acquittal, or possibly a mistrial if the jury fails to reach a unanimous verdict. But in this key legal test for the Me Too movement, the prosecution has claimed that the Hollywood producer treated his victims like ants that he could step on without consequences.
Nick Bryant. As China implements new measures to tackle the COVID-19 coronavirus outbreak, the World Health Organization has been giving an update on the latest situation globally. Its Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus said 92 cases of human-to-human spread of the disease had now been identified in 12 countries outside China. On Friday, it reached the continent of Africa for the first time, in Egypt. The patient is reportedly not Egyptian and is now in isolation in hospital. But as China is one of the continent's main trading partners, health experts are concerned that if the virus takes hold in other African countries, it could be extremely difficult to contain. Pumza Fulani sent this report from South Africa, home to the continent's COVID-19 testing laboratory.
So you can see, if the suit is not the right fit, the zip is going to fold like this and you're going to struggle.
In Sebokeng Township in the south of Johannesburg, a group of paramedics are watching a colleague put on a medical safety suit with gloves, goggles and face mask.
So what is he going to do now?
Wash hands.
So he washes his hands.
They are being trained on what to do if coronavirus comes to South Africa.
The nice thing about these guys is that they deal with infectious diseases every day. So basically what we're doing now is just refreshing them on those procedures.
This is JP van Bjerneke, a paramedic. He says they are already receiving dozens of calls every day from people who are worried they have the virus. So they run through a checklist before leaping into action. Like, for instance, has the person been to China?
And then what they look is which area of China. They look at contact history. So just merely being in China but without contact or somebody with coronavirus would not fall the case definition. And then we look for something like a fever, symptoms like a runny nose, a sore throat, like your flu symptoms, a headache.
Hello. Hello. How are you today?
In Johannesburg's Chinatown district, a vibrant street of vegetable markets, restaurants and grocery stores, some people are wearing face masks. They tell me this is just a precaution.
So people who've recently come back from China have decided to stay away from the business district. I'm standing in front of one shop. It's a restaurant that's been closed for about 10 days now. I'm told the owner has decided to stay away to try and keep people from panicking.
Michael Sun, a community leader, says they are doing what they can to detect any possible signs of the virus.
A lot of the Chinese shopping center owners, they're taking precautionary measures. They've got a team of staff going to the shopkeepers with forehead thermometers to measure temperature, just to say, hey guys, we want you to be healthy. A lot of the sanitizing going on. If you go visit the Chinatowns, business is fairly quiet.
The global public health community believes that it still may be possible to contain the spread of this virus and not give rise to a global outbreak.
Currently, only a few centres across Africa are able to test for the virus. Professor Cheryl Cohen works at one of them, South Africa's National Institute of Communicable Diseases.
We know that Africa experiences a very high impact from seasonal influenza, and therefore it is likely that the African continent will experience a higher impact should there be a global outbreak. And I think that really needs to be a focus of the global community to strengthen health systems in African countries and put in place practical measures to mitigate the potential impact of such an outbreak.
With Africa having recorded its first case of coronavirus, the preparations being made now will be key to how well a potential outbreak is contained.
That report from Johannesburg by Pumza Fulani. Backpackers to Australia may soon be helping to rebuild communities ravaged by the bushfires. The government has announced plans to change visa rules in order to help rebuild properties and vital infrastructure. Kate Gregan has more.
Since September, fires across Australia have killed at least 33 people, destroyed thousands of homes and burnt more than 11 million hectares of land. That's an area almost as large as England. Now, the Australian government has announced plans to rebuild the devastated areas by changing working holiday visa rules. Backpackers in the country will now be able to stay longer if they help out on farms that were affected by the bushfires. Until now, the working holiday visa meant that workers had to change employers every 6 months, but that's now been extended to 12. The Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, says this will be crucial to help people rebuild.
It's a big plan to get the bushfire-affected areas back on their feet. I mean, it's a very practical thing, putting fences back up so stock do not just roam everywhere. This is a big problem, and it's a very practical problem, and it's at the heart of what our decision is today, to help them get those fences rebuilt as quickly as possible. But it's a huge task, and it's going to take some time.
The government hopes that as well as repairing fences, working holiday makers will also contribute to rebuilding homes while also helping with demolition, land clearing and repairing dams. As an extra reward, backpackers who stay in one place for a year will also be given an opportunity to apply for another visa to spend a second year in Australia.
Kate Gregan. A 70,000-year-old Neanderthal skeleton has been unearthed in a cave in the foothills of Iraqi Kurdistan, reopening debate about the cultural sophistication of ancient humans. The skeleton was found in a dugout channel with a big stone by the head, suggesting it was intentionally buried. The remains, called Shanidar Z, are being held at Cambridge University's archaeological labs here in the UK. Pascal Harter spoke to Dr. Emma Pomeroy, who's an archaeology lecturer at Cambridge University and a bone expert on the Shanidar Cave project.
These finds are really quite rare, and it's important because there's been huge debates about how similar Neanderthals were in terms of their behaviour and their cognitive abilities, so their intelligence and their way of thinking to us. And one of the key lines of evidence for this is around how they treated their dead. So in many modern human populations, the treatment of the dead is imbued with a lot of ritual, and there's important ceremonies that take place around that. And of course, there are practical ways in which you might just bury your dead, for example, to move the body out of the way to stop it attracting scavengers. But when that starts to incorporate a symbolic component, that tells us something about the capacity for symbolic thought, for abstract thought, and perhaps ideas of compassion for others in the group and for perhaps feelings of loss, for example.
I understand that previously it was thought that pollen in the burials, there could have been a contamination of the burial site, but this time it seems as though flowers were put there with the dead.
Well, quite possibly. We're not sure at this point. So the new remains were directly adjacent to remains that were found in 1960, known as Shanidar 4, and samples of the sediment from around those bones were found to contain clumps of pollen by the original excavator, Ralph Zalecki, and Arlette Leroy-Goran, who was a pollen specialist. And they argued that this indicated that flowers were put in the grave with that individual. Subsequently, other people said, well, maybe it's just modern contamination because the skeleton was left exposed for some time while they were working on it, or perhaps it was down to burrowing rodents who are known to drag flowers down into their burrows. So what's exciting about our new find is that it is really close to that original flower burial, and we do have some evidence, some microscopic evidence of for the preservation of plant material, including some pollen.
Dr. Emma Pomeroy. Still to come in this podcast.
Pluto had it coming from the beginning. It was never really belong. Pluto's orbit crosses that of another planet. That's no kind of behavior for a planet.
It's had a rough few years, but happy 90th to non-planet Pluto. Vladislav Surkov described himself as one of the authors of the new Russian system. He served Vladimir Putin as former deputy head of the presidential administration, later deputy prime minister, and then assistant to the president on foreign affairs, but no longer. On Tuesday, he was let go by the Russian president. So did he jump ship, or was he pushed? Sarah Rainsford is our Moscow correspondent.
Being sacked or being let go, I think let go is probably the phrase for it. Certainly his resignation has been signed now by Vladimir Putin. As for why he's going, well, the man who leaked the information that he was leaving suggested that this was due to a change of course in Russia on its policy to do with Ukraine. Now, the Kremlin's been very tight-lipped ever since that rumour was leaked. Mr. Surkov has always been very close to the negotiations on Ukraine, certainly to Russia's policy on Ukraine, right back to the start of the conflict in 2014. There are questions being asked about whether this heralds some change in Russian policy, perhaps some softening of its policy. Perhaps Mr. Surkov, who'd been very much heavily involved with the negotiations, specifically with the rebel leaders, the pro-Russian leaders in the east of Ukraine, the breakaway regions, whether it means that they're going to have to make some bigger compromises now and that there might be better, closer relations, more talking between Moscow and Kiev.
So what did Vladislav Surkov mean when he called himself an author of the new Russia?
Well, he's very much been seen here as the ideologue of Vladimir Putin's Russia. He's been named variously as the puppet master, the key political strategist in the Kremlin. He's certainly been seen as one of the key figures pulling the strings behind the scenes, very much behind the scenes. He's not really a public figure. He's very close to President Putin. He has been for a very long time. And he's the man who really coined the phrase sovereign democracy for Russia. Sometimes it's called managed democracy, but it's that very tightly controlled system which allows very, very little dissent that we've come to associate with Vladimir Putin. Now, I think, you know, it is obviously Putin who is the man in charge, but I think he has looked very closely to Vladislav Surkov for many, many years. A lot of speculation, a lot of questions about what this means, whether it is about Ukraine or whether it's more broadly about the direction of Russia.
Sarah Rainsford. A Danish court has sentenced a former senior civil servant to 6.5 years in prison for stealing $17 million from the country's welfare agency. Britta Nielsen worked at Denmark's Social Services Board for 40 years. Jens Lomani reports.
The case is unusual for Denmark, which is admired internationally for its transparency and comparatively low level of corruption. Britta Nielsen was accused of siphoning the funds meant for people in need into her own accounts. She confessed to the fraud involving non-existent projects over 25 years. She explained that she had been drawn into a vicious circle, saying she had acted to improve the lives of her three children. They have also been charged with handling stolen goods. Ms. Nielsen was arrested at Copenhagen Airport in 2018 after voluntarily leaving South Africa, where she fled before an international warrant was issued against her.
Jens Lomani. 3 years ago, Kenya set the world's strictest ban on plastic bags. Harsh penalties are imposed on anyone caught manufacturing, selling, importing or using them. Yet not everyone is complying. Three street traders in the capital, Nairobi, appeared in court today charged with using banned plastic bags. So exactly what are they accused of and what punishment could they face? Mary Harper is our Africa regional editor.
The Environment Agency posted a photograph on Twitter of these three men with plastic bags filled with fruit. There were plums, passion fruit, pieces of sugarcane. So they were accused of using these bags and face up to 4 years in jail or a fine of up to $40,000.
So as you say, the photos were publicised on social media. What's been the social media response?
It's been huge. Kenyans have been bombarding Twitter and other forms of social media, basically attacking the Environment Agency and the authorities for, as one Twitter user put it, targeting the small fish in society, these people who are obviously incredibly poor. And they're saying even though they agree with the ban on plastic bags, they shouldn't be targeting poor market traders. And some people have been saying, like, what's going to happen to their families if they're dependent on the meagre incomes that they earn anyway, if they are incarcerated.
So how widespread is illegal use of plastic bags in Kenya?
It's really reduced massively. Since this ban was introduced, it's almost impossible to find a plastic bag. And in fact, when I go to Kenya, you're even told, don't bring plastic bags in your suitcase. So now they have these kind of fabric bags that people use instead.
You might say Africa as a continent has taken the lead in banning plastic bags. What's the situation like in other countries?
In some countries which are quite authoritarian, like Rwanda and Eritrea, they have banned them several years ago. And in fact, Rwanda now wants to introduce a a ban on any kind of single-use plastic. And there, because those countries are ruled with such iron fists, people really do obey them, like I was in Eritrea a couple of years ago, and everyone just walks around with a cotton bag that they use when they go shopping. What is upsetting when you go to some other countries and you see plastic bags absolutely everywhere. They're stuck on the trees, they're all over the ground. And one of the problems, apart from causing litter, is that animals who roam freely quite often eat them, and then the plastic bags get all twisted up inside their stomachs and sometimes they die. So they are a really big problem.
Our Africa regional editor, Mary Harper. Over the past few months, two of America's largest dairy producers have filed for bankruptcy. In the past decade, the number of dairy farmers in the US has fallen by a third. There are a few factors contributing to the decline of America's dairy industry. One could be what you order when you go out. Samira Hussein reports from New York.
This local coffee shop in Brooklyn offers three kinds of milk to its customers.
Flat white with oat milk.
Only one of those comes from a cow.
What did you order this morning?
I ordered a chai with oat milk.
Do you always order oat milk?
Sometimes I order almond, but then I keep hearing bad press about almond milk. So now I'm like, oh, I better go oat for a while.
During the summer, we drink the iced nine spice chai latte with oat milk. I mean, it's crazy. It's Brooklyn.
Of all the alternative milks out on the market, oat milk is the newcomer, and its popularity has skyrocketed, with sales in the U.S. surging more than 600% last year.
We get 2 to 3 boxes of oat milk every Monday and then 2 or 3 more on Fridays for the weekend.
Hannah Bonagaro works here at the coffee shop and for a time did all the milk orders.
Hannah, what are you making right now?
2 oat milk cappuccinos to go.
How popular are these alternative milks?
They are pretty popular. I consider them kind of the norm at this point. I actually am kind of surprised when people order whole milk these days. And I always recommend oat and almond.
And oat milk makes up only a small part of the alternative milk market, which in 2017 was globally worth almost $18 billion. Far from the trendy coffee shops of New York City, it is on American dairy farms where the impact of those changing taste preferences are being felt.
Where are we going now?
We're going to go into the dairy barn where they're milking.
Inside the barn, there are about 100 cows quietly munching on hay as they wait their turn to be milked. I say quietly because in the hours I spent on this dairy farm, not a single cow made a sound.
This happens to be one of the nicest, coolest cows in the barn, right? This is Stella.
Rick Osteroff has been farming since he was a child. His father was a farmer. His children and grandchildren are also farmers.
When I was a kid, every block, every mile, there was another farm. And you always believed they'd always be there. And now you drive around, you drive down some of these back roads, and you see all these farms, the barns that are falling down, and no one's there anymore. It is so depressing.
Demand for alternative milks may be on the rise, but sales of cow's milk has been declining for years. Milk consumption in the U.S. has plummeted 40% since 1970. And American farmers have been bearing the brunt of the decline. In the last decade, 20,000 U.S. dairy farms have closed.
But she just loves people, right, Stella? If you just, you want to scratch, huh?
Can I just say that it is only coming in here when I see you with the cows that your eyes literally light up.
No, you can't help it. Like cows. Why do they farm? You farm because you knew her mother, you know her babies. Right, it's okay.
The popularity of oat milk and other alternatives is not the only reason for the decline of American dairy farms, but it is certainly a contributing factor. With Americans drinking less and less milk, the danger for U.S. dairy farmers is clear. On the farm, profits are already being squeezed and bankruptcies are on the rise. A long-term shift in tastes is threatening the long-term future of one of America's oldest industries.
Samira Hussein. Finally, in this edition of the Global News Podcast, it's 90 years since Pluto first came onto the scene. Not the animated dog. Well, actually, yes, the animated dog is 90 years old this year. However, that's not the Pluto we're talking about. I mean, the planet. Only it's not actually a planet anymore. Whatever it is, it's 90 years since astronomers discovered it. It's probably a good thing you don't have to rely on me to tell this story. Rebecca Wood can do that.
Some have compared it to Disney's Snow White having six dwarves rather than seven. Or how about the Three Little Pigs becoming just two? Or maybe Prancer being dropped from Father Christmas's team of reindeer? I'm talking about the demotion of Pluto from the official list of planets. Reclassified as a dwarf planet by the International Astronomical Union in 2006, it caused outrage among young and old alike. Celebrity astrophysicist Neil deGrasse Tyson was one of those in the firing line for his involvement in the decision, but he had this message when he appeared on The Late Show with Stephen Colbert.
Get over it. Okay. Yeah, Pluto.
So why do you think people want to name it a planet?
Pluto had it coming from the beginning. It was never really belong. Pluto's orbit crosses that of another planet. That's no kind of behavior for a planet. No.
You gotta stay in your lane.
Stay in your lane.
Stay in your lane.
Stay in your lane.
The science behind it probably had a point. To be a planet, you need to have a nearly round shape. You have to move around the sun, and you can't go into another planet's orbit. And it's that last one that Pluto falls short on, occasionally crossing over into Neptune's personal space. But that wasn't enough to stop the hate mail flooding in and campaigns to reinstate its status. Controversy aside, let's take a moment to celebrate its anniversary. It was discovered 90 years ago by a young amateur astronomer called Clyde Tombaugh at the Lowell Observatory in Arizona.
A tremendous thrill came over me and I almost shook. I realized I had some big game. And so then the thing was to study it and make further checks. Then I went down and notified the other members of the staff. Well, they were electrified.
And if you fear demotion has somewhat lessened that thrill, Pluto fans do not despair. Instead, head to New Mexico, where Tombaugh went on to teach astronomy and where a law has been passed that says Pluto is still a planet when it passes through their skies.
Rebecca Wood. And that's all from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Jonathan Savage. Until next time, goodbye.